Since this article is part of our weekly reading, I will not go over it in detail, but merely note several of the highlights that I regard as significant. One of the reasons for including it here is because it comes from a very respected journal. From the Annals of Internal Medicine, it's an article written by a member of the medical profession for the medical profession, and it's helpful for us to look at the arguments contained in the article, partly because it does give a good history of the development of eugenics, both in this country, in the United States, and in Germany, and in Europe at large, and also because it documents very clearly and specifically analogies, which I think we should regard as important points to continue to watch in regard to the development of an institution that one can describe as absolutely opposed to the good of humanity, i.e. the rise of National Socialism in Germany and its ethical activities, particularly in the area of genocide and eugenics, and also because in our current discourse in the United States, whether in politics or in more broadly moral settings, it's often said that the first person to mention an analogy with Nazi Germany has lost the argument. In other words, it's regarded as hyperbole, as something that's inadmissible, as an appeal to the emotions that really has no value in rational discussion. In this case, I think we can clearly see that there is value to noting the analogies, that it can be very instructive for us and sobering as well. Again, I'm going to highlight certain areas of the article without going over it in detail. And notice that I've given you the abstract at the very top, that the methodology was to look at the history of the eugenics movement and then to look at specific editorials into very prestigious journals of medicine in the United States, the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association from 1930 to 1945, and use that as a touchstone for comparing what was going on in the United States and in Germany. Notice also that the author does emphasize the significance in the United States not only of public unease but Roman Catholic opposition, highlighting for us again the significance of the position of the Catholic Church in being able to make eugenics an illegitimate option. If we look at the introduction, there are some points that we've not yet raised, and that is the rather more remote origins of the idea of or the concept of eugenics. There was a Frenchman named Joseph Arthur de Gobineau who was one of the first to create the idea that somehow the Aryan race or the Aryan archetype could be used as a way of defining racial or ultimately genetic health. And then the authors of the article go on to point out how the first eugenicists regarded themselves as what they called social Darwinists, that is, people who attempted to make use of Darwin's observation and apply them to what they regarded as the ills of society. And notice that in the concluding paragraph of this first section, there is an emphasis that we've mentioned before, that it really was the growing prestige of science. We've mentioned this in regard to the rise of paternalism in medicine, but it was the prestige of science in the 19th century that caused people to imagine that social and moral problems could be described as scientific issues to which a scientific answer was expected. And things like moral decadence, crime, and tuberculosis, venereal disease, alcoholism were thought to be symptoms of what was described as hereditary degeneration, things that could be addressed by promoting certain kinds of marriages and forbidding the birth of certain kinds of children. Then in number two, the eugenics movement in Germany. You've read this, and we won't go over that in detail. In number three, the Nazi transformation of the medical profession. One of the big differences between the medical establishment in Germany and in the United States is that Hitler was able to take control of the medical profession, encourage membership in the party, make adherence to his own eugenic and ultimately racial policies central, and associate this with academic appointments and salary, that one had to be loyal to these positions in order to make progress. Then in number four, the Nazi eugenic sterilization program. We've already looked at this in detail in Papineau's article, from which a certain amount of this information is taken, and again a reminder that it was the Roman Catholic Church in Germany that specifically opposed this sterilization legislation, and that the Nazis allowed a conscience clause for Catholic judges and for others not to have to be involved, at least initially, in this sterilization program. Ultimately, it moved, and this is number five, from eugenic sterilization to involuntary euthanasia. Beginning in 1939, a program of mercy killing was instituted, initially for what were described as eugenic reasons, putting to death children who suffered from what were regarded as unacceptable ailments or genetic problems, and also adults who were suffering from terminal illnesses. There was opposition not only by the Catholic Church but by the Protestant churches to this, and although it officially ended in 1941, and notice that 70,000 persons had been forcibly euthanized at this point, but it did continue until the war's end, and of course its mechanism was specifically applied in the racial extermination attempts that were also undertaken by the Nazi officials. In the United States, number six, there was this idea of progress that could be made toward social goals, and then in number seven, we've already looked twice, once briefly and once in a little more detail, at the development of these laws in the United States and the tragic fact that 23 states enacted these sterilization laws, which were motivated, as the authors point out, primarily by eugenic and, quote, therapeutic, unquote, concerns. And indeed, theoretically, voluntary laws could, in fact, become non-voluntary, since one was very often dealing with individuals who were not felt capable of giving consent. Perhaps it's our country's emphasis on economic issues that allowed in number eight a fellow named Leonard Whitney to acknowledge that one of the reasons for disposing of defectives was in fact a financial motivation, that economic independence and value to society ought to be criteria according to which human worth would be judged. And Whitney concluded, that Germany was going to make herself a stronger nation. And here's the myth and fear behind eugenics, that there will be somehow the creation of a stronger, better race, and that these individuals would be able to somehow dominate the marketplace or dominate the world as a more successful and more rapidly breeding group of individuals. Then in number nine, we have the tragic fact of juridical association, judicial acceptance of forcible sterilization. And this was primarily the case of Buck versus Bell in 1926. It involved the compulsory sterilization of a young woman named Carrie Buck, who was defined as feeble-minded, and again this meant of low intelligence. This was not a very clear psychiatric or psychological designation. Her mother and the daughter of this woman were also regarded as feeble-minded, and Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great justice, wrote this infamous and horrifying statement: "We've seen more than once that public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for their lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. It's better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind." The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. So, the famous and revered Oliver Wendell Holmes describes himself here, portrays clearly his support for forcible sterilization, for programs and for reasons that are effectively eugenic in origin. So it's impossible to regard eugenics as something that was somehow confined to a very small minority of individuals. A large number of politicians, even presidents and governors throughout the states, and again, the laws would not have been passed in those states if there had not been strong judicial support for it. This was a characteristic of the United States, especially in the 1920s and then through the 30s. There were, however, those among the developing practitioners of the science of genetics who questioned whether or not eugenics could be accepted for its rather simple assumption that preventing the breeding of certain individuals would result in the elimination of those traits. And they developed, as you can see in number 10, some mathematical suggestions that, in fact, the principles according to which the social agenda of eugenics is being carried out might well not halt the propagation of even what were regarded as genetically defective individuals. This was debated in a variety of contexts. And then the real point of the article in number 11, to note the response of the medical profession in the United States, and in number 12, a report from the American Neurological Association. And if you drop down then in number 12 to the text that I've highlighted in white, despite their own opposition to compulsory legislation, the committee expressed respect for the German eugenic sterilization law of 1933 because of its precision scientific grounding and procedural safeguards. Remember, this is a law that is permitting the sterilization of people with epilepsy and alcoholism. So, the committee recommends five disease groups for which voluntary eugenic sterilization could be considered: Huntington's chorea and a number of other degenerative neurological diseases, familial feeble-mindedness, and again, this is low intelligence, schizophrenia, manic depressive psychosis, and epilepsy. So we see that they're borrowing from the German eugenic sterilization laws, assuming that these are diseases which should be eliminated by forbidding those who have them to have children. Nevertheless, there was a concern, and given that it wasn't an American institution, hopefully one can be glad that there was such a concern, that forcible sterilization was problematic and involved a violation of human rights. In number 13, the New England Journal of Medicine, the editors conclude that feeble-mindedness was probably inherited as a Mendelian recessive trait, meaning that if both parents had the recessive trait, it could appear in their offspring. And they conclude, we should recognize this danger that threatens to replace our population with a race of feeble-minded, an inflammatory kind of accusation intended to evoke fear. If we wait too long, this viper that we have nourished may prove our undoing. And a conclusion that Germany is the most progressive nation in restricting fecundity, the ability to reproduce among the unfit. And they conclude that the individual must give way before the greater good. I should add that there are few journals, medical journals, in the United States with greater prestige than the New England Journal of Medicine. To be published in that journal is to have one's scientific efforts regarded as having been well-established and well-reviewed by one's peers. So that approbation, that approval of the German approach would have been reflective of and also would have had influence on quite a few members of the American medical establishment. The Journal of the American Medical Association, which is assessed in number 14, was less inflammatory. There was a more neutral stance, but certainly there was an outrage at the thought of positive eugenics, that is restricting people's ability to breed, and then finally, in number 15, we find the specific conclusions about the comparisons between what was going on in the U.S. and in Nazi Germany. And if you notice the area that I've highlighted, common sources of inspiration that were found in both countries involved, number one, the belief that scientific management could solve social problems by preventing the propagation of the unfit, a willingness to measure individual worth in economic terms, and justifying strategies of diminishing the number of individuals and therefore the cost of defective populations, and the conviction that mental illness posed a serious enough social threat, and the belief that certain races, and again the concept of race is largely mythological and of no real genetic significance, the belief that certain races are superior to others. So there are very clear analogies. And finally, in the very end of the article, the area that I've highlighted, that the difference was that in the United States there was public unease, there eventually was judicial review and acknowledgement that this did involve the violation of individual rights, and a continued scrutiny by the medical profession caused eugenics to be regarded as less an obligation or a necessity, and finally something of an embarrassment, and the American clergy and lay members of the Roman Catholic Church were often the most important opponents of legislative proposals for eugenic sterilization, and this is true especially after Pius XI condemned this practice in Casti Canubii, as we have already seen.